Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Fire up those DiGiorno pizzas because Earwolf's Womp It Up is back with new episodes.
That's right. Everyone's favorite Comedy Bang Bang intern, Marissa Wampler, and her co-host, Charlotte Lisler, are throwing on the cans once again.
In every episode, Marissa and Lisler interview a different colorful character from the world of Marina Del Rey High School and give listeners relationship advice.
Their latest guest is the head of the high school newspaper, Mr. Casey Steers.
If you haven't listened to Womp It Up before, if you love Comedy Bang Bang, then you're really going to love this.
Listen to Womp It Up on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Earwolf.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Womp it up, womp it down, get yourself to Womp Town.
Welcome to James Bonding. I'm Matt.
I am also Matt of the Gorley variety.
I'm Matt Myra. Joining us today is a special treat for all of you. You clamored for him.
That's right.
I don't know that that's true.
One of our most popular episodes of all time.
Is it the top?
No.
That record is held by James Bladen, I believe.
Who was going to be on today.
He was going
now,
to.
Now, what was his episode?
Cold opens ranked.
Oh, sure. I think I angled for that because I had a feeling like that one's going to be the... That's going to be the top one. I want to be in the two top ones, and then they won't be able to distinguish whether it's me or the top one.
Well, I think we're pretty sure it's the content. So on Andy's episode, we ranked all the songs of James Bond. I believe that's still available. If not, it's on Stitcher Premium.
It's Andy Secunda, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the show.
There he is.
Be back.
Andy, for those of you who aren't familiar with Andy, he's a wonderful improviser, writer, director, producer, all kinds of things, and he's also my co-host on Star Trek The Next Conversation.
By the way, we're in the middle of the second terrible season of Star Trek The Next Generation, and Matt Myra invited me to be on the Bonding podcast, and I was so excited. I was going to be like, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to take a break from these terrible, terrible Star Trek episodes we're wading through. To enjoy any of the number of Bond films I love so dearly, and it's Die Another Day.
And we gave you this lemon. Had you seen this before?
I have, yeah. I've seen all of them, but I think I only saw it once in the theater, and I was like, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, once in the theater is enough. I remember seeing this, I think, in the theater, I'm pretty sure, and just feeling like, how can they charge money for this? Other
I can't
than
believe
that they spent so much money. And
I can't believe you just said
back.
You think you saw this in the
I
theater.
I did. Because I know that Tomorrow Never Dies is the only one I haven't seen in the theater since I started going to the theater.
Matt, I know how much you love it. So I've tracked down a 35mm print and I'm renting out a theater.
Whoa. That I would do.
I thought you were presenting it right now.
Yeah, I wish.
If I'm making noise, I apologize.
That's all right.
That will happen a lot. This is going to be the downside of me having a mic stand. I'll play with it the entire time.
So this is Pierce Brosnan's last foray into the Bond films. And this is the second to last one we're going to cover this go-round.
Second to last Brosnan.
Second to last. Well, if we still have to do World Is Not Enough, which is in the middle of Tomorrow Never Dies and Die Another Day. And I just have to say, I feel for Pierce Brosnan throughout this movie. The fact that he's in it.
Well, I feel for everyone in this movie, specifically Judi Dench and Rosamund Pike, who are still turning in really worthy performances that feel out of sync with this movie.
Yes. Judi Dench especially it's astonishing how she escapes the terribleness of this film.
Did she rewrite her own dialogue? Because it really it's literally the only way. Scene that doesn't have pun answered by pun, by metaphor by pun, and like
I'm not going to say that. So you can do what you want.
When you say action, I will speak, but it won't be the pablum written on this page.
I did some research about the relationship of Britain to North Korea, and I'm going to incorporate some of those details.
Something inches closer than what you have here on the page. Oh,
this movie, you know, I always... Here's what I'd like to say off the bat. This movie always gets a bad rap for the invisible Aston Martin. Mm-hmm. And that is the least of its problems.
I agree with that.
Or you may be generous. It is among the many problems.
No, but I feel like what everyone always says is like, ugh, I have an invisible car? That's when I was out. Yeah. Like, that's sort of the thing everyone points to in this movie.
That's true.
Like, when in reality...
a lot of stuff to step off the boat before you got to the car.
Yeah. Step off the surfboard.
Surfboard with the weapons hidden in it.
The thing I do like about this movie, though, that every time I see it, I am still somehow surprised at how bad it is. Like, it is
that
never...
is something.
How many times have you seen it?
Oh, I don't know. I've probably... maybe seen this one like 10 times, maybe.
Really?
Well, just, you know, like...
you got it. It's on.
I can't count how many times in my life, well, probably 10, where I went, let's go through the Bond films again, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
With friends. Yeah. Or, you know. And then sometimes you watch this one just because I've seen the other ones so many times. Here's one that I haven't seen as much.
Right.
But I still, I'm sorry this is controversial, would put it above, like, the Tomorrow Never Dies just because it is... surprising at how bad it is.
You are crazy.
Tomorrow Never Dies is the Michelle Yeoh one.
Yeah. And because there's like, it's so bonkers. This movie's horrible, but at least it's like, whoa.
I can't believe
what is going on.
And I don't mean and to which one is attack the one, you, man. I'm sorry.
Which one is the one with the remote controlled car?
Tomorrow Never Dies.
Yeah.
That is... I feel like, to me, that's more offensive than the invisible car, because it's the only purpose is
this
we
car,
can sit in the back seat.
I'm sorry.
Exactly.
Hang on.
This is at least a cartoon.
Hang on.
Yeah.
This car, he controls with the key fob by pointing a laser at it and moving it as he wants. So that is not weird to you guys? You guys are okay with that?
No, it's weird. It's this movie actually... is 100% a satire of James Bond movies. Imagine if you put... even if you put Mike Myers in the role of Bond, the way they all speak, the secondary henchman is Mr. Kill. The woman is named Mrs. Frost. Like, they're just, it's so on the nose that it's totally a satire. I'm not saying that's what they're intending, but if you put different actors in this role, they would go like, oh, look at this send-up of a Bond film. It's so bad.
I was curious about you guys' take on that in terms of, there's no question that this is a terrible, terrible film, which I'm sure we'll get into all the details, but are things like the names and the bad choices, like, aren't a lot of those things sort of basics of Bond films?
Yeah, but well, they are so distilled.
And it's also such a, it's a lazy effort.
Yeah,
it's a kitchen sink effort.
Right.
Where they're just like, well.
How about this?
Well, that's another thing I can't figure out. Were Purvis and Wade under directive to go like, take it a step farther, or were they trying to get themselves fired?
I don't know. When you look at the early story drafts on this, it's much better.
What is it?
You read the early story.
Listen, guys, I'm going to pull out the notes.
Oh boy!
Here we're back at the James Bond archives.
That's right.
This is a
book, and I was going to say those aren't notes. You're lying to them.
This memo is dated Notes on XX Meeting. So this is Bond 20. It's the 20th film. This is from June 5th, 2001.
Okay.
All right.
That's right, because this came out on the 40th anniversary,
right.
I think. Yeah. Big, wow.
So this is what they've already looked at a draft, and this was a discussion between the writers and the producers. Number one, we need more of an explanation as to how someone as fantastic as James Bond is kept in a prison for 3 years. Possibly show him in virtually a box for 24 hours a day, sensory deprivation. Show him being brainwashed, shades of Harry Palmer. Show it being a Spandau prison-like setup. Bond, the only prisoner. Here's where it starts. I don't know.
That is Spandau Prison, and is it Germany?
Spandau Ballet.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of. Here's where it gets interesting. Number two. Wade is waiting with Falco when Bond returns.
Falco?
Falco is Mike Madsen's character.
Mike Madsen.
Have we seen him before?
No.
No.
Because it's treated as though we've seen him before. I know. Yeah.
See him damned by Wade. There was a suggestion that Falco is taking over for Wade. More explanation as to how Bond can slow his heart. It can be done
that could
visually.
Oh, that sequence. I'm sorry. He uses traumatic memories that would raise your heart rate to lower his heart rate. Like, they show the montage of what he's thinking about, and they're all things that would make you
tense. I didn't even put together that that's what was happening. I thought he was just under... Are we sure that he's doing that intentionally? And
yes.
He's just not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's and it says, could it be?
I thought it was just he had stress and then he happened to luck out.
No, yeah. No. He slowed his heart down. And then it says, could it be mentioned by M in the first scene, i.e., how did you just survive type of thing? And he could talk about his slowing heart rate. Number four, M comments humorously on Bond's genitalia post medical.
Wait, that's something that's in the script notes?
This
that's
is in the notes.
That
like, we need that, or that...
This I don't know.
Judge would have been like, no. Not going to do that.
Next. The North Korea freelancers who attack in the elevator were sent by General Moon.
Okay, so these are notes on an existing draft.
Yeah.
Then. Okay.
Why is Zhao at the clinic when Jinx hits it? He was there to... For the change, Jinx was only there to kill the doctor and take records and diamonds, i.e. cover Graves' tracks. So in this version,
Frost?
No, Jinx is working
with
under Falco, who is the person that is leaking to Graves. So in this movie, there is no Frost in this version.
Okay, Falco is the mole.
Right. I wonder if Jinx is in on it or doesn't realize
she doesn't realize it.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Did you know? I can tell you why. Jinx is there to deliver the diamond. She's an unwitting tool of Falco, the stooge. She is a 00 mopper upper. She has her suspicions that all is not right as early as Iceland? ? Falco is possibly after Bond. Is the CIA monitoring equipment that spies him in Antwerp? Falco is with M in the underground station? Bond never releases the tension of believing he did release names. This can be dealt with in a Falco or Jinx scene. That I kind of like, where he's not quite sure. Did he leak the information? You know, because he was so beaten and tortured for X amount of time. You know, when I said this was better beforehand, I take that back. I apologize to everyone listening. This also seems like garbage.
It is.
What the fuck were they thinking? This movie is crazy. So this is the 20th Bond movie. This was like, let's do a big Bond. It's a new millennium of Bond. Let's welcome him into the 21st century. And, I think in that sense they were trying to throw everything in they could.
Yeah, you're right, especially signified by all the gadgets in the background of Q's lair, and they really are like, let's do every Bond trope, every big thing, and then notch it up a bunch. But man,
but from an homage perspective, or
I think it was a little
perspective. No, or what?
I think they were trying to homage a little bit,
homage and heighten, I guess, like just celebrate. They were definitely, they obviously are conscious that they're going big with this one, obviously. But
yeah.
I don't think they realize how, I think they know they're doing camp, but I don't think they know how flat it falls, you know? It's just.
The tone of this movie.
This is post 9/11.
Okay. And I think we should, it is, but they were working on it pre 9/11. I think we should discuss the fact that this is, because right off the bat in the opening scene when they're surfing into North Korea.
That's theoretically when they're writing the script, that's the first choice they made. That's the first thing they sat down and they went, let's get him surfing.
Maybe it was sort of like, you know, you do your vomit draft.
Yeah.
It's just like,
yeah.
All right, we're obviously not going to leave it. Yeah. with three guys just surfing in North Korea.
You know, it's funny you say that. Guys should say that. Because the last note on this is the pre-titles do not yet deliver the requisite action stunt quota, and maybe the capture of Bond is not yet right. However, this has not been a priority.
Oh, that reads that way on screen.
The great part, at some point someone went, let's get him surfing, and then do it again later in the film.
Well, you have to set up that he does have surfing capabilities, right?
But they don't.
I'm kidding.
I know. That's the other thing is, I can take a little bit of the Bond can do everything and knows everything, but at what circumstance did Bond growing up in England and Switzerland really get a chance to surf? It had to come later in life. So he's just somewhere
on... What is your guys' perspective on... It's interesting over the span of all the Bond films when he does run into something that's like, by the end of the sequence when he's facing a villain, never say never, never again isn't canon, but like he doesn't know how to play the video game. And then by the end, he knows how to play the video game. Do you, like, what's your guys' perspective
I'm
on
okay
how
with
they
like, yeah, when he's a good adapter, I'm okay, but right. I hate when he goes into everything an expert.
Well, to that point, Andy, good point. If that video game shock device was in this movie,
right,
Pierce Brosnan's James Bond would be the best player in the world immediately.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Immediately. Yeah. Like, he's already, like, the world's greatest sword fighter.
Yeah.
We'll get to that scene. But like, the thing that is the most unsatisfying about the surf sequence is that nothing happens.
No.
It's just a mode of transportation.
It literally
is. I said this, I think, last time. They would have been better served just scuba diving in.
Because then at least it's like, it's James Bond scuba diving, we've seen him do that.
Yeah,
it is literally a confusing situation, and it's so dark. This I'm gonna say it right now, this is the worst looking James Bond movie.
So terrible.
100%.
It's
either garish or bland. I also say, and I looked up the budget just to see, and the budget is about, you know, on par with the other budgets. It looks like every scene is just, we have this room, can he walk around this room and talk to some people? Now we have this room, can he walk around this room?
Well, yeah, it is
now
really
we have
poorly
a terrible
lit.
CG blue screen exterior.
That's the thing. Right? I am not entirely sure how much of that blue screen is blue screen, and I think that a lot of it is this color correcting that Lee Tamarai was doing. Because like the color correcting and the speed ramp that he does throughout the film is such a, this is exactly when I was in college, and this is exactly when I was editing, and this is exactly when I was learning how to use all the software, and everything he does in this is stuff that the shitty students in class would do.
Because
Final Cut Matrix, Pro 3 finally had a color saturation filter that you could use and do this weird thing where if you went too far with it, it would look like everyone was in front of a green screen when in actuality you had actually shot outside in Massachusetts. And I watched the... I think I've watched the behind the scenes doc on this DVD, and boy Lee, he is delighted by these things, especially the speed ramping, and especially during the car chase at the end of the movie. But it is so laughable. Also, like, here's another question for you. The credit sequence where they're showing Bond's torture.
Yes.
It seems It's interesting to me. It is a little bland, but it is interesting to me that they're also trying to pack story into that.
Yeah, we've talked about this, that it is an anomaly that they do that. You get that a little bit in On Her Majesty's Secret Service where they're recapping, but never quite moving the story forward like this.
Yeah. This is, I don't know if you want to go up to him being captured.
The beauty of this show is that we've all seen it, and the listeners have seen it, so go to where you need to go.
Him being captured, because it really struck me, and it was one of the things that was in my memory, and I don't remember if this was the film or not. This is the first time in Bond history he's been captured and held that long, right?
Held that long, yes.
Yeah.
Well, every other time he's captured to the point of the note. Were those notes from the producers?
I believe so, yeah.
which were, I think, valid notes.
Yeah.
He's Bond always escapes. Right. He always figures out a way out. And they don't explain why he doesn't figure out a way out. But more to that is...
They do a little. They say they kept him on Scorpion Venom, and then Venom, kept reviving him.
Which is brought up and then never brought up again. So then my second question, which is, even as a child, I was watching it and going, well, why is he... How do they not break him? Oh, you can't break Bond for 18 months?
Yeah, I know.
I don't buy that without some explanation.
No, they're just...
I don't buy that you were a child in 2001. If I was in college.
Oh, no, yeah, that was... It's really like... I was old then.
There's two categories of Bond films, and then they have a spectrum within, and that is Actual Man and Superman. And right. This is the epitome extreme end of the Superman Bond, where he's just... It's just he might as well be a superhero.
But then the fun of the Superman Bond is like, and say Connery or Roger Moore, is that they're having fun.
Right.
And with Connery, it's a little darker, and with Roger Moore, it's a little campier. But it's like, I'm so confident I'm not going to get hurt and everything's going to be okay that I'm enjoying it. And you get none of that.
No, because Brosnan's still playing it like he's really... I mean, in some way, my hat's off to him. Like, he is playing the stakes of the situation. He's trying, but it doesn't fit with the film.
Listen, as an actor, he's dealing with a situation where he is having to play a character. Like, and, you know, for all of the Pierce Brosnan back and forth we do here on the show, I think genuinely we enjoy him as he's a great screen presence. And but he is... To his credit, he is trying to act based on what the material they've given him. And the material they've given him is...
It's a caricature. It's not a character.
Yeah.
Especially in this film. Nobody's a character in this
film. He's also trying to be a guy who's been tortured for 18 months and has been abandoned by everything he knew.
And then...
And like, he's trying... He's layering that...
Are they playing
in his performance. He is.
Well, he is. And then it immediately falls into the dumbest movie. And so it's so at odds.
It's crazy.
Yeah. I actually like some of the middle stuff or the earlier stuff where he goes to the hotel.
That's
in this
great.
Movie. That feels like Bond.
I like the idea of him being captured, tortured, being traumatized by it in a way we haven't seen Bond do it. But it's not addressed or layered into the film.
Casino Royale does it and they do it. It's one of the best moments in a Bond character development and history. And I love it. That hotel sequence in this film is kind of like... where all the dark stuff in the beginning is giving way to the really stupid lighter stuff, but it's like that crossover moment that actually everything kind of blends kind of nicely. Like the tone seems to work.
On the nose, when as soon as you hear London Calling, this movie.
Oh, yeah. But I'm just talking about that.
Just
like
goes.
Just where he throws the ashtray at the mirror, and you know that feels like the heightened... campy spy level stuff that works, you know, and he knows that guy from Chinese intelligence and he's getting his tailor there and it just kind of works. I mean, relative. I'm talking about in this film, this is the high point for me.
That was another scene to me that felt like, it just felt like a terrible set. Like it was just a tiny low budget set.
I think that's the lighting.
How about if he breaks the mirror? That would be kind of interesting.
And it's just like so nothing. Highly lit. It's so
lit and
That speed ramping, I can't believe
they set it up for like a few minutes with all the bullshit espionage talk. speaking encoded stuff at the concierge desk or whatever it is. Then they go into the room and they have the girl come in and that takes a while. And then he throws the thing.
No coded espionage stuff in that scene.
Isn't when he goes and talks to the manager, there's a little bit of...
No, I think that's being played as...
Again.
That's being played just as James Bond is a frequent guest of that hotel. And
but
has an unlimited
knows
credit.
He doesn't...
Bond knows that he is, but...
That guy doesn't know
that guy doesn't know that Bond knows that he is.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I can't believe with that speed ramping stuff, the way they shoot it, that they can't... Even at the time, have the foresight to see, like, this is not going to be around forever. Why would we put this in a Bond film? It's supposed to be timeless. This is the only one. And then it makes me think, is Spectre going to feel that way on that handheld shot in the beginning? Because that actually is kind of a...
For sure.
Yeah. It's not as egregious as that.
You know, all these movies sort of date themselves in various ways, but this is by far, we're now 17 years out from this movie, 15 years out from this movie.
It feels more dated than
this. This is by far the most egregious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
pretty.
And I'm just going to read this quote from Lee Tamarai.
Is it Tamahori?
I always have heard him say Tamarai.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Okay.
We had to watch his film in college,
The
Once Were Warriors.
Once Were Warriors, yeah.
And that's how they all pronounced it.
Okay.
So, I don't know. Which is a great tiny film in New Zealand about the natives and, like,
I'm going to look up what he's done since.
He didn't go right from that to this.
I feel like he might have. Here's what he says. I was given a script like a secret agent. For your eyes only, it said on the cover. The first page read, three men in night vision goggles with body armor and camouflage suits surf in and on the largest waves in the world to the Korean coast. I thought, God, this is fantastic. I've got to make this movie.
Oh, jeez.
Not the first reaction you should have from reading that.
Here are his credits.
I read it and went, what?
2016, The Patriarch, never heard of it. The Devil's Double. The first film I've heard of is 2007, Next, that
Nicolas Cage movie where you can see the next 10 minutes or something like
Triple
that.
Triple X, State of the Union, Dying Every Day. He did Along Came a Spider as well, and an episode of The Sopranos. Oh, he did The Edge and Mulholland Falls.
Oh. Jennifer Connelly's very pretty in that.
In The Edge.
I remember thinking, like, why did Jennifer Connelly do this role?
Okay, I didn't. Okay. We get it, Andy.
On what Jennifer Connelly
should be doing.
Was capable of what parts she was capable of getting and not getting at that point in her career.
Well, let's talk about this opening sequence.
This is the first time that a bullet goes into the thing, right? Into the barrel?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I forgot that this movie got shut down too.
It
because
did?
Of an injury.
Whose injury?
Pierce Brosnan.
What happened? Are we seeing some actual hurt acting and not acting?
Following day, the crew were in London in a house in Stoke Newington shooting the scene in Havana where Bond meets whoever the hell that is, played by Mexican actor Emilio Echevarria. That afternoon, Brosnan requested a doctor to attend to set after developing pain in his knee following a stunt a few days earlier. It's a physical film, and you put yourself in the action as much as possible. The knee went. Why? Because I didn't stretch. It's as simple as that. I was running away from all the Koreans, hopping onto a hovercraft, thinking I didn't need to stretch, and pounded the old knee out. Brosnan was sent to Princess Grace Hospital in London for an assessment. And then he had to fly back to see a specialist in the UK, in America.
By the way, I don't know if this is if the subtitling was racist or not, but I usually keep subtitles on. And it said, when the guards are coming up on the beach, it said, chattering in Korean.
As if, like whatever, it's not important. Yeah, they're just babbling in Korean.
Foreigners are saying.
Oh, my God. Who cares?
Okay, yeah, the cold open is, listen, it's very Bondy as far as the taking over the guy's identity, trying to blow up some people.
He's got the exact same clothes as that.
I was just going to say, is that, that's not necessary. They don't know what the guy's dressed in.
No,
right?
But it
and then he takes his sunglasses like, the final touch.
They either, like, reconned this guy that morning as he was getting dressed and then somehow were able to have the resources to go get me that exact outfit. Or did they plant it on him?
Maybe he always wears that outfit. Like Einstein, he always picks the same outfit to save space in his brain.
And is there a reason why Colonel Moon has all of his sports cars there? Or other than
I
just
think he lives at that palace, right? So I just assume they're there.
I sort of interpret them as more stolen, kind of corrupt goods. To show how capitalistic he was, even though he was...
Or are they hiding them with the weapons in the demilitarized zone or something? I don't know. That's a palace? I thought it was just kind of like a bunker.
Yeah, it seemed kind of crappy, along with anything else.
It's North Korea. What are you going to do?
And let me ask you this. So he puts in the C4, and then he puts the diamonds on top of it.
Yeah.
What is his plan? What is he trying to do?
Oh, I think he's just trying to blow them up, right?
He's trying to kill Moon?
Yeah.
Why doesn't he just kill Moon then?
I think he's gonna get the diamonds to them. Exchange whatever the hell needs to be exchanged. Get back on that helicopter, and then blow it up.
Is he there
when
to
he's,
bust
when
the
he leaves.
Diamond deal or to try to get the like weapons? Because
the explosion is very small.
Yeah, it's not nearly big enough for what it should be.
It's just big enough to insert diamonds into someone's face.
Exactly.
Its intended purpose. Yeah.
It's more of a distraction.
Yeah. I will say I do like Bond getting out of that.
Yeah.
I do like him like looking around, like clocking everything.
Yeah.
And then deciding when to blow the diamonds, when to take the hell.
It's just the hovercraft chase after it that's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, you just have to. You're left with not many crafts that we haven't seen a chase in.
Right.
You're dealing with a James Bond movie.
They got
all
of them.
We've been to space.
Ice sailing, surfing, and hovercraft.
But I guess this is what confuses me about the budget being equitable, because it kind of like, in watching it, I was like, oh, they must have decided that Brosnan wasn't as profitable, which wasn't accurate.
Yeah, this was big money.
Huge movie for them.
Yeah, they gave this money less money, which isn't accurate.
Yeah.
So if you compare this to the GoldenEye opening, that's the one with the plane, him dropping out. It was just amazing.
I know.
But it was a very small plane.
Yes. We can only afford a small plane for this.
Not
stuff.
Like the giant plane in this movie.
But like he drives the hovercraft. They sort of drive through a forest. There's a little bit of fighting on a thing.
They're driving through a minefield. It's not a forest. It's a minefield, guys. Uh-huh. And that's why James Bond can use his Uzi to blow up mines.
I couldn't help notice the irony when Colonel Moon's talking about like I majored in Western hypocrisy, and his whole basic thing is like, you West, you're so decadent. But that's exactly what this movie is. Like, it's the worst sins of Western decadence. There's no substance. It's all form.
It is such such a movie from 2002. It's not even funny. It's more 2002 than 2002 was.
I know, but you know, like if you were
2002, because I do associate it with the 90s. But the problem with the early 2000s is that we're desperately clawing onto the 90s, which was a terrible time in film.
Right. If you were asked me to explain 2002 to you, I couldn't do it. But then watching this movie, I would just show someone this and go, "Here, it." It still doesn't feel like it has an identity, but somehow that identity sort of shoots through as horrible. I don't know. It's
The diamond guy, by the way, in keeping with the time period, was from Fast and the Furious.
Oh, really?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
When was that first movie?
I think that was a year before, a couple years after.
Ricky Yoon.
Let's find out.
He's from the first movie, right? He's the bad guy in the first one. He drives the Honda S2000.
Yeah.
Boy, I remember that movie too well.
2001, yeah. So it was the year before, and he was the villain.
I think Ricky Yoon does a great job.
He's a good-looking villain.
Yeah.
I did have a question about henchmen, and also, and what you guys' perspective is over the span of henchmen. He's got diamonds in his face.
Yep.
Then he doesn't get to finish.
Big criteria.
Yeah.
His gene he's therapy, like that's why his
fourth
blue
step.
Eyes.
Yeah. Well, they've turned,
right.
Yeah.
But also, like,
why does he stay bald? Is that I know?
I think that's part of the gene therapy. I think that's part of it.
They were going to make him bald.
Well, you see the transition.
Yeah.
Faces,
he's
right?
He turned into a German guy.
But like, was he just the step before they removed the diamonds from his face?
I know we've talked about this. You'd think that'd be first because you probably need some healing time. Right?
All right. First thing we got to do is we're going to get these diamonds out your face. Wait, why are you in Cuba? I don't know. I'm just working at this clinic.
Why couldn't he be another guy with diamonds in his face?
The other thing, the most disappointing... Okay, there's a lot of disappointing visual aspects of this movie, but I think number one for me is that all of the snow looks fake.
Yeah.
And
the ice, too. So
that's
it's not even glass.
Here's
glass
the glaring set things that like sort of stuck out for me, okay? Number one for me is how much of a set the set looked like for the courtyard sword fight.
Totally.
The lighting was
it is the lighting.
Atrocious.
I think it has to be the lighting, because I bet you this other sets look that shitty, but if you light it well...
I think you may be right.
It's so bright, and yeah.
Orly has a background in scenic design, so he's right.
Oh, I guess he's the expert now, Andy.
You don't know, Myra. You don't know nothing. Gorley's doing a victory dance right now.
That's good.
Yeah, no, I agree. The sets are terrible. And that, I'm jumping ahead to the ice castle, but even thinking about the ice castle, it looks small and purposeless in the wide shots. And then in the close shots, when they're kind of going around it and doing stuff, it seems tiny, even though you're just deciding what the scale is every time you build another shot.
Right. Yeah.
Why would they make it that way?
I don't know. I actually was watching this trying to go, like, let me find some good in this film in some way. And the best I could do was obviously Judi Dench, and Ricky Yoon is good. And
oh, so my question about that character, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
Finish your point.
Well, I just wanted to say that the score is pretty bombastic, but it's still really good in it. I still really miss David Arnold because he puts some real Barry stuff in here. Jinx's intro has such a melodic, sweeping kind of orchestral thing that I really wish they'd bring him back.
David G. Arnold, a big fan of some of your work. This is garbage. This movie,
but
there's
it's
so much
to the movie, and it's very. I thought it was pretty good. You didn't like it.
No,
it's garbage, which did the previous theme.
That was Jess Shirley Manson.
This is as good as garbage.
That was Jess Shirley Manson. I actually, it was audibly annoying to me, the music. Mm. Like
It certainly matches the level of the film.
For sure.
It had to. I don't think you could do a subtle score with this film. It would seem,
but it's also so. Again, so of the time, the score is like so of the
I thought they would go like heavy Moby or back to something like, you know, a little bit more techno. Now he puts elements of that into his score, but there's still a lot of orchestral stuff, horns and
maybe it's just the Moby-ish stuff that I'm hearing and that is like sticking out in my brain because it really is like the. Ice Palace stuff, particularly the party stuff. It's like really like it's just it really kills my brain.
Was there a Russian production on this one because that's what like the Clash sound drop and stuff like that feels like. It's like just put this in.
Oh, a Rush, and then we'll in. Oh, not a Russian. I thought you said Russian.
Was there a Russian second unit?
Did the Russians sabotage this film?
We prove collusion between this film and the Kremlin? We might be able to.
Just because it felt like they had all this stuff in it, and the sound, the music stuff that you're talking about, I think falls into it, where it's just like, this will do for now, and then we'll fix it, and then they didn't have time or something.
Yeah, it could be. Mad and Podcast. Stitcher Premium has a new series from award-winning British comedian Josie Long.
Oh, Josie. I love Josie. It's called All the Planet's Wonders Shown in Detail.
Through this original scripted alt-comedy series, Josie Long will attempt to better herself and get out into the world with help from Maeve Higgins and a host of other comedy pals.
Also featuring Earwolf favorites like Aaron Whitehead, Hayes Davenport, Zach Rhino, and John Hodgman.
And British comics Humphrey Kerr, John Luke Roberts, and the Illusionist podcast's Helen Zaltzman.
Gain fantastic insights about topics including exploration, insects, and fossils.
Travel with Josie and Maeve to the bottom of the ocean in James Cameron's submarine and find out why Josie's dated so many men with a love of rocks.
Give it a listen and make Josie Long your new favorite international comedian.
For a free month trial of Stitcher Premium, use the promo code BOND at stitcherpremium.com/planets.
Ooh. Mad and Podcast.
Did Brosnan... I did a little bit of looking up on it, but I didn't get clarity. Was he like done with it, or were they done with
him? They were done with him.
Or was it a financial
decision? He wanted to do more.
And they... said no because why?
They wanted to move in a different direction. I think maybe they had recognized their missteps, but we've often heard that Broccoli and Wilson trade off helming these films. Is that right? I wonder if that's real.
I don't ever remember hearing that.
Yeah, I
Is
heard
this
that
something
somewhere.
You heard in some sort of club you're meeting at without me?
Oh yeah.
Oh,
in the Blades Literary
James
club.
Bond Club.
Yeah.
Oh, Myra,
no. I have a secret podcast where we don't even broadcast. We set up mics and don't record. It's pure art.
Have you ever
Could
done
you
that?
Do that?
You ever done a podcast that wasn't recording?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, isn't that the worst feeling
awful.
In the world?
That's awful.
Hey, guys, if we did a podcast and we only released it to, like, people who paid $1,000
like
each.
The Wu-Tang Clan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we get Martin Scrum. Andy, you're just describing Patreon.
Oh, is that what it is?
Yeah, you can tier it at levels. We could set it at $100 a month, and then they can get a free episode.
I'm interested in that. Let's come up with a concept.
All right, Andy, you're our first Patreon supporter. Thanks, buddy.
What? No!
That's what you said.
You're interested in it.
Matt and I are going to do an episode just for you.
I wanted to be paid to not do much. Not pay much, pay a lot to hear nothing.
I just can't really come to terms with everything in this movie. And it's hard. It's really hard for me, too, because I love Pierce Brosnan, and I, you know, that's my teen years were the Brosnan years.
Is he your guy is Craig, right?
Yeah.
And who's your guy, Myra?
Well, Craig's the... I can't argue with Craig.
We both really like Moore. And Moore Connery, too.
Connery, and Connery's the...
Like, and Dalton. I like all of them.
Spreading it thin over all the bonds there.
The thing that is the worst about this film, other than in, it's the worst film in many ways, but the dialogue is the worst of any Bond film, hands down.
Well, this is the thing this is why I was confused, and I understand now that I missed information, because I thought that first conversation it wasn't an espionage conversation with the hotel manager, but it felt like it. And then
because of how disjointed the dialogue was.
And then the next big sequence is when he talks to the Cuban guy.
That's espionage.
Like, okay, make sure we're both on the same page kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then the next thing
He's a sleeper cell. I love that.
Huh?
I love that. I love the Cuban arrival. I love that scene. The delectados.
Yeah.
What aspect of it?
I liked that this guy is a sleeper agent who has been in Cuba operating now for 40 years. Uh-huh. He has been going about his life. Has not been activated in decades.
Uh-huh.
And James Bond comes in, knows exactly what to say to him, and then the sleeper agent is activated.
So it just has the history of something. So, yeah, I think that's accurate. But anyway, my point is, then the next thing is when Halle Berry comes out of the water, and I feel like they have a conversation that sounds a little
bit... It does sound so jilted.
I was completely confused.
They're not speaking like humans. They're speaking in double entendre, that response to double entendre that's so bad that it sounds like a spy code.
It makes no sense.
Do you love the woman? The woman is my friend.
Exactly.
Let's continue.
Yeah. There are many predators around. The predators come out at night. Yes. And then I'm like, oh, they know each other. She's an agent...
It's bad double entendre.
And then they sleep together too much so credit. Fast. And, you know, Bond will
sleep. I like, because if they're trying to set up Jinx as the female equivalent of James Bond, then I believe that those two go to bed quickly.
I agree with that, but the problem I have with it is, what does he think is going on? He's just thinking, well, I'm James Bond, so she's going to want to sleep with me? Because I feel like it's an interesting question.
Which is the whole
how you ground it. Like, you know that everyone wants to sleep with James Bond, but this felt like, oh, something else is going on, because there's no logical, nothing has transpired that convinces me that those two people would want to sleep with each other, other than if they're both agents, or if they have a prior history, or if something, there's no chemistry, and nothing they've said makes any sense. So there's no logical, something else going on, and then he wakes up and she's gone, and I'm like,
they're just taking it on faith that American audiences or global audiences, I guess, take a look at two beautiful people on a screen and go, well, they absolutely are going, it's a ticking time bomb before they sleep together.
But if that's the truth, and maybe this is the truth with really super attractive people, they can just go up and go, gobbledygook, gobbledygook. Yes, I agree. Bloopity blue, bloopity blue. All right, you want to go have sex? Yes.
They literally, like, when ugly people aren't around, they just talk to each other.
Nonsense.
Absolute
words.
Gibberish. Yes. Chattering Korean.
Right, whatever. We both know where this is going to end up. What's the point of even saying words to each other?
Yeah. Let's go.
Keepler.
Frankly, I see even when they're having sex, when she pulls out, what is it, a pomegranate and starts cutting it? That is the same kind of nonsensical, like, well, we're both so hot, it doesn't matter what I do here.
I know, yeah. Oh, my God.
Maybe this movie's more true than any of us care to realize.
It could be.
Oh, they're pulling up the curtain.
I have a question to pose to you, gentlemen, about the James Bonds. Now, in this movie, when they get to the fencing scene.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't believe that Pierce Brosnan can beat this guy. It's in the execution. It's in a bit of the age difference, unfortunately. But there's just it's just the first time I'm watching Brosnan where I'm like, there's no way this guy can't beat Bond.
I agree with
that.
But
what I liked about that... Oh, no, keep going.
Well, just... I think every Bond...
Also, the stunt doubling is preposterous in particular.
Every Bond actor has that moment in their run where... You go like, it's just not believable anymore where Bond can beat these younger villains. So who is it for? When was it for Connery? When was it for Moore? It might not happen for Lazenby or Dalton.
Moore definitely had it in Octopussy. There's everything he does in that looks like.
But I might even go earlier, like the hockey sequence in For Your Eyes Only.
Totally.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
and is there any before
you're saying
that?
In terms of skill or
I would step
just
it back.
Whatever.
Step
like,
it
it's
back
just
to Moonraker.
Shot.
Step it back to Moonraker.
Which scene?
It's when he's fighting the guy in the glass factory.
Yeah.
There's like, no, you're just the lumbering that Moore is doing in that scene is just like, I'm not buying this anymore.
There are moments in Spy Who Loved Me where I feel like he's still kind of holding his own.
Yes.
Yeah. It's
and
probably
if you go back to Connery, for me with Connery, it's by virtue of the fact that he's training with ninjas, it's you only live twice.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, I don't
well,
buy
that
any
is,
of this.
You know, that's why I like so much. When you see Bond, like, I mean, I guess the quintessential version is when he's fighting Oddjob, is just like, he knows he can't win this.
Yeah,
he's got to figure out a different way
to
win this.
I like that, too. Yeah.
And with Jaws, and most face-offs with Jaws, it's like, he's too powerful.
Yeah, they're playing that.
And that kind of ties back to my question about Zhao, is that his name?
Yeah.
Ricky Yoon or Moon?
Zhao.
Ricky Yoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Zhao.
Is he's got the diamonds in his face, he's got the blue eyes. What else is threatening about him? And I feel like that was a pattern after maybe Jaws. You guys, please correct me. Like, none of the henchmen seem like
well, they
these
just
people
give
that
the physical,
beat,
the physical character.
It's the same thing as Jinx and Bond being beautiful. You just take it for granted. It's all shorthand at this point.
Right.
And that's why it's not working anymore. But has Craig had his moment where he doesn't seem. Believable. He's definitely better, and physically he's more suited, but there is that moment when they're escaping from Blofeld's lair, Inspector, where it does feel like he's just not,
I think that's post-ACL. I honestly got it. I think that's right after the ACL tour, and that's like his first day on set. That's my guess.
But they do the thing when he's fighting Hinks in that train, like the Jaws thing, where he's just kind of like looking at him like, oh my god, I gotta... He's just kind of fighting and
oh, when he's being turned around... When he's being carried, when he's being held by Bautista.
I like they play that up. So
I like
I think,
that too.
I think Craig is still hanging in there. We'll see in the next
It's
one.
Really interesting to me, you know, because we had so much distance from Spectre. And by distance, I mean, what, 2 years now? That
You guys
when
didn't
that
like
came
it.
Out,
you
we
liked it.
Loved
and then you
it.
Decided
we loved it.
You
we
it
loved it when it came out.
But I also haven't really watched all of it in a while, so I'll be curious when we get back to it.
It's like when... Like, when I think back to the best sandwich I ever had in my life, I had hiked up Mount Washington as a Boy Scout, which is the highest peak in the...
we got to hear this story.
On the Atlantic seaboard, on the Appalachians. And you go up, and then when you reach the summit, it's not like a hike. It is trails. So I'm not climbing anything. I'm just walking up trails. But we got there, and they made me a bologna and cheese sandwich on white bread with mustard. Mm-hmm. And that is the best sandwich I've ever had.
That's
only
really
because
good,
of what I endured previous to that sandwich.
Sure. Yes.
So the sense of like why Matt and I liked Spectre so much is we had starved for a James Bond movie for a couple of years.
That's true.
And then we had it and we're like, this movie was the best.
Yeah.
I love James Bond.
Yeah. Whereas like now if you put that sandwich in front of me, I'm like, I don't want that. Yeah.
Although I would take that sandwich right
sure,
now.
Sure.
That sounds really good. Let me show you guys a picture. There's a moment in this movie that if you were to show someone this picture, they would never in a million years say this is a James Bond film. It is a close-up of Graves getting his DNA replacement, but the silver mask with the white like fiber optics coming out of it. And in the background is a cloaked Zhao that looks like the Emperor. This looks like something out of Zardoz. Look at that. That belongs nowhere in a James Bond movie. Zhao's in the background in a cloak. It just looks like some bad sci-fi movie. Look for that when you watch it.
That's right. It did. I think it subconsciously did make me think of Zardoz.
Yeah. It's just, what? When they saw this, they didn't at any time go, what are we doing? What have we done here?
Well, I mean, you know, I texted
it's so
you.
So awful.
I texted you both the image of Brosnan being electrocuted.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the power suit.
Yeah.
What? So he's got, he controls the satellite, but he's also got it built into some kind of armature.
Yes.
That electrifies people when they come close to him.
Yeah, yes. Naturally.
Sure.
Yeah. Which was first?
Well, it was the, you know, when he says to the guy to ask the guy to finish it.
That's right.
Yeah, he's like,
oh, you mean Vlad?
Vlad.
I like that guy.
Do you think? In
I like
script,
that guy too. He's
his haircut is in keeping with Bond.
Which
you
one's
know,
Vlad?
He was like the scientist, weird looking dude.
Oh yeah.
Like he appears in multiple Bond films.
I enjoyed
Bond
the comedic moment of him coming up and saying, "He beat your score."
I know. Yeah.
It is. Nice.
Hey boss,
your time.
It is. Think of the insanity.
One of the only
that
successful comedic moments.
We go from fucking. We go from this. This Graves strangling Bond in an electric suit.
Yeah.
To this.
I know.
Like, it is crazy.
It's nose bleeding. He's showing a picture
of
Craig in the bathroom at the opening of Casino Royale.
That really says the reason why for, like, all right, we're done with Brosnan. We're done with this era.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is...
It's not his fault. Pierce, I love you. It's not your fault, buddy.
I feel like the performance is, to a certain degree, his fault.
Yeah, I agree.
I feel like the script is definitely like, you know, you can't get over it, but he, there is no joy coming from this performance at all.
Nobody is here for love of the game.
The essential.
He does not even
I
have...
feel like Roger Moore was in some terrible Bond moments, and he always seems to be having fun.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Hmm.
The thing, getting back to
really
the score, how
here.
I was saying, like if you took that score too seriously for this movie, it wouldn't work. That's a bit of what Brosnan's doing. He is really trying to play this in a gritty way that just, this movie, the lighting alone is the least thing it is gritty.
He desperately wanted his Casino Royale.
Yeah.
He desperately wanted a down-to-earth James Bond movie.
Roger Moore's the only one that got a reset in his run. The resets usually happen after the actor leaves.
Mm.
His goes from Moonraker to For Your Eyes Only.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
The reset being, we're going to take it more seriously?
Yeah, back to grounded.
I do wonder what he would have... done what that fifth Brosnan would have been.
I think that is that was the problem, which I accept now in the grand span of Bond films that GoldenEye has a lot going for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I was hoping for a Casino Royale full on ground Bond again reset at GoldenEye.
Yeah, me too.
And I feel like he did not. They did not do that.
He got a reset.
They reset it a little bit.
I think a lot. If you look at what was before it, if you look at License to Kill, I mean, they obviously have to snap back from that.
Well, it's like they reset from Dark to the best of what Bond does as a trope film.
You know,
like,
if you
they
look
didn't
at,
go gritty, but they went to the best version of a fun Bond
film. It'd be interesting to look at who has the best first movie. You know, I mean, we know it's Daniel Craig.
Yeah.
Like, we get that. But, like, it's interesting because, like, I love Live and Let Die. It might be, because Honor, Majesty, Secret Service is a fucking perfect James Bond movie in its own way. And I think that Casino Royale is perfect in its own way. And I think GoldenEye is perfect in its own way. And I think that Dr. No, obviously, is perfect in its own way. It is interesting when you look at those. And Living Daylights I like more than License to Kill.
Yeah, me too.
So I think
I love Live and Let Die, but I don't know if it's the perfect first Bond
I think that's
movie.
I only found
the
out
lowest
yesterday
of the bunch.
Going through, I didn't realize that was the first Roger Moore film.
Yeah.
Oh, Live and Let Die, really?
It is a weird one to start with.
I'm surprised that he survived that.
By the way,
that run, because Live and Let Die is crazy.
Live and Let Die, which happens in early 70s Harlem for part of the movie, is less dated then die another day.
That's true. Or at least more timeless in some way. Yeah.
It is. I don't.
How
like,
is that possible?
I don't understand.
Certainly, the characters in Live and Let Die are less dated than a lot of lines that Halle Berry.
Halle Berry, I've said this before, and I've asked them to take away her Oscar for this movie, which she won while this movie was in production.
But, you know, it's. Things that are recently dated are more glaring than things that seem now. Like Live and Let Die is basically a period piece at this point. Like it's historical.
For sure. But Matt, we're almost 20 years out of this.
I know, but it's still a period that we remember personally, and so it's always going to be more jarring to us because we see the flaws in our own persons at that time. You know. But think about this film. It reminds me actually of watching Diamonds Are Forever. It like Jinx and Jill St. John both have kind of like an emptiness to their performances.
Mm.
It's jarring and weird and I love watching Diamonds Are Forever. I don't know that I'll ever feel that about this, but I think someone in 10 more years will go like, oh, this is bonkers. I love it.
About Die Another Day?
Yeah, because they will be 15 years younger.
This is the interesting question. I don't know if they, you know, age always messes with everybody's memories and how old you were when you saw it. But I feel like that is the essential thing that is my perspective about this film that is the problem, is all the craziest of the Bond films, until you get into the Dalton Brosnan era, have a certain joy and fun, and even it's like the people making them were like, what if we do this?
Because they were going to these locations and partying.
What if there are two ladies that are doing gymnastics and kick the hell out of him? Like, you know. And in this, there's like, it's all like, oh, just get to the next scene.
Yeah. It's a machine at this
point. I will
say,
though, in regards to Jinx, I think that do we have other female characters prior to that are female sort of sidekicks that are good, that are as physically able as she is?
Barbara Bach.
So I feel like she's the one that's driving most of the action in this film, more than Brian.
Oh, they're setting her up.
Barbara
Bach.
You mean as a physical, like, fighter?
No, I just mean like as a Bond comp. And Michelle Yeoh.
Yeah, Michelle Yeoh.
Michelle Yeoh, yes, I guess that's true.
And I think, you know, it's always like...
But even Michelle Yeoh is physically capable, but isn't doing a lot of... It didn't feel like she was doing a lot as much as like
you know what?
Like Jinx is doing her own whole
spy
plot.
She is, because they
that's
are
why she was
trying
gonna get
a
spin-off.
The spin-off. Yeah. Thank God it never happened.
Oh, I'd love to see it.
I would like to see it too.
Yeah. I mean,
it'd be miserable.
Oh, but, you're saying you would like to see it because it'd be terrible.
But
I feel like you could have taken as they take terrible Marvel characters and make them good. I feel like you could have.
To Andy's point, that is interesting to think about. You know how we have all these, you know, there's all these women that are spies that are counterparts to James Bond, and then they become love interests eventually to him.
Yeah, they get neutered or fixed.
We have never, and I'd like to see it. I'd like to see a counterpart to James Bond actually be his like partner throughout a movie.
Well, I think that's what this is. I think they do pretty much maintain it. She kills Miranda Frost.
I mean a male. Like a male counterpart.
Oh,
I know you didn't get that because I clearly didn't say the words.
but you sure corrected.
I don't know why you guys didn't warn in my head at that point.
That's a really interesting question, because I feel like the problem is it kind of gets to something primal about what James Bond is, which is James Bond. The reason we enjoy him is he is the ultimate alpha, and you're suggesting.
Yeah, but like I would love
a second alpha.
Yeah. I would love it in the next one if they fucking gave Jeffrey Wright the full Felix Leiter of it all.
Oh, I wish they'd give him a whole movie.
And they actually throughout the movie had to work together. Like that'd be interesting, instead of like coming and going through the plot to like sort of like give James information.
Yeah,
I think it would be interesting to have a
buddy cop,
have
James
a Felix Leiter. Be a Jinx.
You know, Jack Lord could have pulled it off, except that they wrote him so that the second he sees him, James Bond punches him in the stomach.
That's right.
And, like, he's done.
You get a glimpse of it in the beginning of GoldenEye, because they're two 00s on a mission together, which you never see.
Yeah. I think that'd be an interesting shade of Bond to see. Yeah. But maybe it doesn't work because Bond is so individual.
That's
true.
He's
so on his own.
But speaking of male companionship, we probably talked about this last time too, but Zhao and Moon are clearly lovers, judging by that scene where they have a reuniting,
right?
Like tender.
Oh,
are they insinuating? I feel like the director's trying to get to that.
I feel like that was implied. It was a weird moment.
They linger tenderly with each other in a way that feels like they're stopping to telegraph that in a way that also has plausible deniability, because it's still 2002 and you can't get away with that in blockbuster cinema.
Is that true in 2002?
Well, probably on a,
right.
And then internationally.
I guess if they're villains, I always feel like you can get away with it. Like, perverts.
I know. Twisted deviants. Of course they come up with a diabolical plan.
But that it also does highlight to me what I think is one of the most problematic things in the film, which is Zhao, I think, is a good, relatively good character, but Moon is all, and like, not just the fact that they, I wondered if Face Off was before or after. It was like 5 years before.
Right.
And this is more silly than Face Off.
Yeah, no kidding, because at least that one's surgical. This one, they're transplanting DNA through the bone marrow.
Yeah. But then also his, not just his face, not just his accent. Are they playing, by the way, the when you go into the hospital and you hear the English voice,
you're getting
they're
tutored.
Teaching him how to do the accent. Uh-huh. But his entire manner, 100%, is different, right, even when he's alone.
Yeah, flawless accent.
Yeah, and it's like sneering, and everything's just completely different. And what's beneath it is completely confusing, like in terms of his character. I don't.
The graves of it all?
Yeah.
Like he's doing it just.
You know, all of it's unclear. It's all very like.
And they try to justify it as like, I know I only knew you for a short time, but.
He was the model for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, it seems like a weird thing to base your whole future life on, even when you're alone.
I know. It's.
And also Rosamund Pike, who I think is good.
Yeah.
Her character, she's following him and betraying.
Yeah, but why is
the Brits? Why?
Because she likes to win. They throw in one line that
she helped her win the
also
helped her win the Olympics.
Also, isn't the throwaway, which makes no sense, the throwaway line here that M says to Madsen's character is that if you had disclosed that she was on the Harvard fencing team with
Moon.
Right. Oh, okay.
In my mind,
I was like, wait, with Graves? Graves was only around for a year.
It's with Moon because he went and studied there.
But also, like,
he went to,
don't you think they
he goes to Oxford and Harvard?
Yeah, but so did Frasier.
Accomplished academically.
Frasier did that too.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And Niles went to Princeton and Cambridge.
No, that's funny.
I'm losing my train of thought on this Graves situation.
There was a scene with Judi Dench where they're like, you already figured that out.
Yeah.
I was a little bit confused about what they were blaming each other for.
I'm
in that
sorry.
Scene.
I remembered what
I think
the
they
thing
were
was.
Too.
It was like, well, don't you think MI6 would know who she was on the fencing
right,
team with?
Right.
There's a
right.
fucking yearbook.
It's true.
You're telling me you're not pulling that?
I know.
And you do so
agent.
Much. You do
they
so much
through the deepest background history.
You go through so much effort to find orphans. Like you go through so much effort to make sure there's no tangential connection to any living person, so that you can exploit these people to become blunt instruments for your espionage. And here you are, not looking in a fucking Harvard yearbook.
All their resources were going towards developing a visible car. Which, by the way, okay, I understand the concept of tiny cameras projecting to the other side. That doesn't explain the clear windows somehow go invisible. Like, and all
you
the
can
interior.
Project through a clear window.
Through a clear window.
You could project. You could project. Like, you can have a see-through thing that is actually a screen. I think it works like
that. Wait, isn't the clear window part of the skin?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm talking about the actual windows of the car that you could see through. They would be invisible on their own.
Yes.
So you're telling me the interior, when he opens the door, the interior is fully visible.
Yeah, no, I think there's the.
I want to hear you defend this.
I'm not going to defend it, but I think conceptually what they were going for is that the light
inventing an invisible car,
the light emitting polymer, is coating the entire vehicle.
But yet they have cameras inside the glass. Tiny cameras have to be.
No. I think those cameras can just be on the door frame and still project based on whatever the fuck the lens is. Now I'm defending this invisible car, and I hate what you've done to me.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I should never put anybody in that
position.
Are you
questioning why it can be? I think it works like a one-way mirror.
I think he was just lost on how the cameras
work. But that would be totally reflective, not see-through. Because they're reflecting the opposite sides, what the viewer would see.
Yeah.
The camera is shooting on the other side of the car and projecting that on the opposite car side of the car.
Right.
But how would that work on the windows?
Isn't it work the same way?
But you can't have little cameras in the windows.
Little cameras.
Why can't you have little cameras in the windows?
Because you'd see through. You wouldn't see through the windows because the cameras wouldn't be.
Can we just... Oh, you're envisioning them as almost nanobot tiny cameras. Well, yeah. I so you see know it as like they have like whatever. Say 50, you know, strategically placed cameras that cover the area.
And that's that's what I thought too. Right. And it's like, you know how have you been in a car that has an overhead view when you're parking?
No, how does it do that?
So that when we were test driving cars, the XC90, we ended up getting the base model, but the fancy model, when you hit reverse, it's got cameras up at the up towards the top of the car, a couple spotted cameras, and then what it does is when you hit reverse, what it does is it projects those and then puts what the car would look like.
That's pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, when you're backing into a spot, you have, like, an overhead view of what you're doing.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Therefore, I think this would work.
Okay.
I don't think it would really work.
Justified.
It's terrible.
Justified. But this movie's great.
I would also be curious if you did a rundown on... Have you done a rundown on James Bond's weapons yet?
No.
No.
But if you did a rundown on weapons, I would be curious to hear a blow-by-blow of, like, here's an awesome weapon. Did he use it in an awesome way? Because they have, all right, you got your invisible car. They never, the way that it finally pays off is that Zhao is like, all right, I'm going to ram you. Yeah. And then as he's driving, it goes invisible. And he's like, what do I do? I have to keep my foot on the accelerator and die.
I should stop.
It's like, what is it turning invisible have to do with?
Also, I love the fact that Bond doesn't use his fucking tire spikes traction.
Ever.
Other than to go up a wall. Like, to come down the wall, he turns it off.
Yeah.
When the car would just slide down, like... Yeah. Leave it on, buddy. It seems to be a pretty...
Also, when he kills Zhao, that thing of, like, he's driving all around, and Zhao's already gone in the water, and then he shoots the chandelier.
I like that.
But even that is shot so poorly.
So red, so fast.
I know. Yeah. They didn't even line the shot up well, so that when the chandelier falls, you can tell it's 10 feet in front of him.
Yeah.
You know, that was shot so poorly. The car chase on the ice is where, if you're going to buy into how stupid this movie is, I at least enjoy that, because it's kind of well done, and this is where it deserves to be lit really well, and all so many missiles and guns in these cars. Like, it's like Spy versus Spy, basically. Yeah. Like the comics. Yeah.
Which should have been awesome, and it also...
A lot of speed ramping in that.
Is this the only time when it's Bond facing another supercar? Because it feels like that should have been, and that's like going back to the 00 facing a 00 kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's what it should be. Like, oh, it's a guy who has all of Bond's skills and his equipment. And this is just like, why does Zhao have all this shit? And there's nothing satisfying done with it.
Yeah.
That's correct. I also like how he opens the missile thing, the grill, and then the Jaguar has like 12 more missiles than Bond does. They're like, ooh, he's outgunned.
Yeah.
Yeah, and why?
It's also like, why does the
North Koreans, they have access to all these
Does the Jaguar panel have to blow away for the machine gun to come up? Like, that's poor design.
But there's a minigun on this thing.
Yes.
Does that pop up, or is that always there?
It pops up out of the back.
Oh,
so the back panel is a back panel that's silver that says Jaguar on it.
These cars are basically from the cartoon Mask.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
totally.
I loved. So I think that's probably why I enjoyed that.
I mean, if you're going to go that cartoony, it should have been awesome. Why was it so...
Listen, it's fine.
Just redundant.
I like it flipping over with the ejector seat.
I love that overhead shot of it twisting, and you see the tire tracks all kind of weave together, like DNA thematically. Oh, it's really, really taking character.
It's also
the theme. What's the theme of this film?
What is Bond entering? Is it the hospital? Yeah, I think it's...
The clinic?
Is it the clinic? What is he... Now I've forgotten the terrible scene where he disconnects the camera.
Oh yeah, he's so easily
just like, how do I get past this? Oh, I'll just sneak behind the camera and pull
I
it
also
out.
Laughed it chirp. Super hard that it made a noise.
Yeah,
that I the know. Camera. So I was useless. Like, are you telling me?
Well, same with his little mini scanner on after they surf in the beginning. That's the worst feature on the stealth thing is a noise.
Yeah.
Oh,
that doesn't have to be
crazy.
There. I just mentioned the jokingly.
But then he
jokingly.
Finds the obvious button, and then he walks in, and it's all DNA
and
spirals.
Mirrors.
Oh yeah, mirrors. Yes, that it looked like Scaramanga's fun.
Exactly,
house.
Yeah. Leftover from Scaramanga.
I was joking about the theme of the DNA, but Phil Nobile wrote that amazing article on Birth, Movies, Death about how Skyfall was it him that wrote that is the only really Bond movie with a real theme to it.
Oh.
And how great that was. And I'm trying to think if any other Bond movies really have much of a theme. I think Casino Royale has a loss theme and Quantum has a revenge theme. And maybe Honor Majesty's Secret Service has kind of at least a love plot, but kind of the theme going on there too. And you do well to have some theme in your Bond movies.
I think that's absolutely
that up
right.
So I make sure that I got
credit
that
right. The right writer.
Yeah,
and tell people where to find it. It does feel completely tin. Like if you were to ask the classic writer question, "What is this about?" then you would have no answer for this. Oh boy,
my notes are also sporadically.
Has this one been done yet? I've tried to come up with something that no one would pick yet. Die a Notzer day.
You beat me. Notes another day.
Oh, there you go.
these are my notes from October 20th, 2013, mm-hmm. when we watched it. I'll say this
just for the first time we see Michael, not the first time we see him, but when we see him in his office, he has behind him an American flag. A cowboy gun,
yeah. I know.
An old-timey football statue, and a statue of an eagle.
Yeah.
Like you might as well just put like Uncle Sam standing behind him and a picture of Captain America
He should. M should video chat, and it should be Sam the Eagle, the Muppet.
Sam, it would have been no more appropriate time for Sam to say, "You are all morons." I'll tell you that.
I want to talk about John Cleese as Q.
Okay.
I love John Cleese dearly, but there is something about this that doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
What is it? Because I buy him.
I don't know. I just feel his introduction, I think, is better. Than this, his solo foray.
Feels lifeless, but I feel like that's in what they were given to do.
Yeah.
It's called Return to Skyfall, written by Phil on Birth, Movies, Death. Great article. Great article. Our man in the East. We're lucky to have him.
Phil, hang in there. We'll talk about this ranking you did. I can't disagree with your Diamonds or Die Another Day placement, though. I believe that was his worst ranked, right? No. Yeah. Was it? Yeah.
Yeah, and I understand why people think this is the worst film. Definitely. Oh. Even though for me it's not, but I definitely understand it.
I can't believe it's not.
What is in the rank? What is in the running beside it?
Tomorrow Never Dies.
No. it's not good news for Brosnan.
No.
Because
I'm sorry, man.
Because
I've never
they're
seen
bland.
Him look so hurt. Yeah, boring is a bigger sin for me than bombastic.
You know
in a
what's
movie.
Weird though, because you know I wasn't a diehard Remington Steele fan, but I really enjoyed it. He was so charming and fun in Remington Steele, which is why you would think he would make a good Bond.
I know.
And then he makes this adjustment when he's doing Bond of like, well, yeah, but I'm gonna be different. And it's like you're cutting yourself off from the thing that's best about
you.
Yeah,
I agree.
You know, it's the same sort of like trope that happens when they're promoting Bond films, and inevitably the Bond girl will say to the press that she's unlike any Bond girl we've ever seen before. She really holds her own against Bond.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that sort of like intention is always there, I think, with the filmmakers to make it different. And I think the intention though from Pierce Brosnan's standpoint is always to make his Bond more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what he wants to do.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I think in every press interview, similarly to the actresses who've played Bond girls over the years, Brosnan, I think, always was touting his wanting to more ground the character, which is something I can't think of other James Bond saying often, you know?
Yeah, Dalton did.
Yeah. Well,
Dalton was another.
I think Dalton does a great job doing what he does.
Sorry, guys.
I like him.
I think he had a certain amount of charisma, and at least he played the stoicism.
Yeah.
He really suffers,
well,
though,
but
from scripts. I think
the scripts were terrible. Yeah,
Brosnan's biggest foible, I think, is all the scripts being terrible.
Is there something happening during this era that was particularly problematic behind the scenes that led to the bad scripts?
Or yes, Cubby Broccoli died.
Oh,
but that doesn't explain GoldenEye, and then the
Cubby Broccoli was alive.
Yeah, but he wasn't he hands off at that point?
Yeah, a little bit. I think they still slipped him a script, probably. Yeah. Casino Royale is the enigma. It really is the enigma.
Why it's good?
Well, it's the deviation from the mean.
You can't tell who's writing what.
Yeah,
we still don't know that about Purvis and Wade because they solely are responsible for this thing. But that's what I'm wondering: like, how much of it is everybody's just like, oh, the natural progression is to go crazy, and so they can obviously tone it down when doing Casino Royale, but what is theirs? What is theirs on Skyfall?
Yeah.
I'm dying to know.
I would love some insider information, but these camps seem to be very closed.
It's very frustrating. It's the thing that we struggle with on next conversation, or I struggle with on next conversation. I think Matt just skims along happily.
I love Star Trek. I'll watch it all the time. I love it the way Matt and I love Bond.
When we see these terrible episodes, and there's a debate of Maurice Hurley being in charge, or was it the writer's strike, or was it when was Roddenberry involved or not involved? And it's very frustrating to me, knowing how complicated it gets on a television show, and even when you're in it, going like, I didn't want us to do that.
All right.
Just like, who's responsible for stuff being good or bad?
I know.
It takes a lot of moving parts.
I wonder how much of this movie was done by committee, because it does seem like the strongest Bond films are the ones where you have something closer to an auteur. But you don't really get those in Bond movies. I don't know. Maybe that statement, I retract that.
But even right from the opening of Casino Royale, it's just such a throwing down the gauntlet of this is what this tone is going to be.
Yeah.
What is Michael G. Wilson? What is Michael G. Wilson's
I couldn't
cameo?
Remember. I don't know, because I thought about that halfway through and didn't see
As it. I was watching the...
I'll look it up.
The fencing scene, I thought he might have been the guy that got the newspaper cut in half. But then I thought, no. And I didn't rewind it to check, but... I was really wondering what his cameo was.
Let me look it up.
One odd detail is Moon, when he's talking to his father, he's quoting Art of War.
Sure.
then he stabs
him. And then she has the book on some kind of a music stand.
Yeah.
So that she can stab him with it.
In an airplane. They needed a music stand in an airplane.
Well, that's even more... And and then she kills her. And going back to the Halle Berry character more of a dated character than the characters in Live and Let Die? It says, "Read this, bitch."
Yeah. Also says
Art of War.
Also says Yo Mama.
That's right. God, yeah. For the first time since his cameo career began in 1964's Goldfinger, Wilson is formally credited for his bit part in Die Another Day. The Bond producer plays General Chandler of the American Air Force in M's Situation Room.
Although
he offers no lines, Chandler's breast is weighed heavily with medals, awards, and apparel.
That's right. He is in that scene. I think we talked about that last time, but I've completely forgotten. Andy, what were you just saying? I'm sorry.
I was talking about Jinx's Read This Bitch.
Oh, yes. So to that point, she does say Yo Mama. But in the scene, she says Yo Mama while they're in a room full of robotic lasers. Now, this, of course, is a nod to Goldfinger, rather.
Seems like a haphazard
100%.
use.
100%. But here's my question. It seems that just by hitting one or two buttons on the remote control, you then get into a mode where the lasers are on and moving around at random.
What mode is that?
What fucking mode is that? Why are the deadly lasers programmed to go
that's plot device
haywire?
Oh,
it's
insane. This button that says MacGuffin mode?
ratchet up the action mode.
She does say, "Yo, mama." It's very uncomfortable.
Maybe it's rave. It's awful. Maybe it's a rave mode.
I have no gloft for this movie. That's a Gorley's lookout for this, except for to say my lookout for this is literally look out for this movie. Like beware, beware. Know what you're getting into. My last note on this thing is Jesus Christ.
And that's an appropriate note. Anything else we missed?
The whole ending. The whole ending sequence has a series of lines. It almost felt like they kept coming up. Is this the last line? No, that doesn't work.
Like yes, they're
I think I broke her heart. I told you I was a jinx. I should have told you relationships don't last either.
You it's said, like, didn't you say we go down together?
Yeah, now what you said something about us going down together. See, it's a perfect fit. So they have all that misdirect, and she has the diamonds on her. And it's
that's like from an episode of
Leave It In
Company.
Just a few more minutes. And it's like
I want Mr. Roper outside going, what?
I know Bond films do all these things. Do they go that
I think they coming off of Christmas Only Comes Once a Year.
Yeah, where do you go from there?
In The World Is Not Enough, the last line of that movie. I think they were like, well, we've got to beat that.
See, still not quite sure how good you are. So good, especially when you're bad. And the thing that bothers me the most is no line of dialogue works as a double or single entendre, nor does it have any connection to the prior line.
That's exactly right. It doesn't work either way.
So it goes back to our theory that they're just attractive people saying nonsense to each other.
Or they're still continuing a spy code language up to the point of sex.
Yes.
Like that's the form of consent is sexual harassment is so bad in the spy game that they have a like 2-day code breakdown that they have to have for consent for sexual relations.
And if any one
mistake.
Yeah, if any one phrase is incorrect, like for instance, if you were to say a line Jake said.
The predators come out at night. I don't remember if that was hers or
and then I would say the that's because the prey like water. Now, because I said like water instead of come out to drink, we couldn't fuck.
Right.
That's right.
What?
Yeah. Oh, but that is right, a third. That's third base. That's what that is. So there's a difference.
I will give
branches.
You a handy and that is it.
Speaking of handies, let's get the fuck out of this movie.
All right. Let's rate it.
Let's Andy, I don't know if you're familiar with this concept, but we like to give things a rating on this.
Ooh, how many Andes are we getting?
Well, instead of Andes, like we do on Star Trek The Next Conversation, we rate this on a scale of 000 to 007.
Oh, I see.
So a great movie would be a 007 and a terrible movie. We have yet to pull it out, but the... Oh, I just double entendred. But the 000 would be the lowest.
I didn't do that for Tomorrow Never Dies?
You didn't do a 000,
I didn't,
did you?
I don't remember.
What did you do?
I don't know. I'm trying to remember so I can go one notch up from that.
Well,
what are your 007s?
We haven't hit one yet.
I don't think so. No.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Goldfinger.
Goldfinger would be the
really?
Only one I would say.
I don't think
Didn't
I did.
Didn't we seven?
Well, we need someone
again,
to make
Again, someone
a chart.
Is probably making a chart.
Yeah.
As they do for us on Star Trek The Next Conversation.
The lovely people that do. Oh, and thank you, by the way. Some people sent in some stuff to Earwolf for us. Comic strips, Condor Man, a nice drawing of the theme park. Thank you very much. That's always very kind.
Condor Man is going to be insane, I think.
Oh, are you guys going to do Condor Man?
I don't know.
I remember being excited about seeing it when I was a kid. My parents didn't take me to it.
But Matt's schedule's opened up a little bit, we're going to actually start getting to some of these offshoot movies, hopefully starting with Casino Royale and Maurice LaMarche, maybe two next week possibly.
Maurice, you're probably listening, so
and he's coming to the live show, so we'll do a little shout out there and talk about it. We're speaking of that,
there's 16 tickets available as of yesterday still to the UCB show we're doing. UCB Sunset
on at this point then almost. See if you can get on there and get them. I don't know. I mean, that's we're almost sold out there.
Thursday night this week, if you're in LA and you want to come see us, please do. We're at the UCB Sunset. It's the Stitcher Premium Presents James Bonding.
And there is a limited series of posters signed by us available December 12th. I think I said December 2nd last time. I apologize. They'll be on podswag.com/12 days. You can also go to /bond.
Mm-hmm. What night is your show?
Thursday.
Oh, Thursday.
December 7th?
I'm performing a show tomorrow there, but it won't be released. I do perform. I perform every first Saturday of the month with The Swarm at 9 on at UCB Sunset.
And, yeah.
That's an all-star lineup, too.
That I think you're thinking of Soundtrack, unless you count.
No, because Swarm isn't Andy Daly and Sean Conroy Andy Secunda.
See, that's an old schooler talking there. Yeah. Calling that an old an all-star lineup.
That is. Matt. Those are all great improvisers.
Oh, they're all great.
And Andy.
Yeah.
That's and we have a self-deprecating perspective on ourselves as being outdated. But yes, they're all great.
If you want to see what comedy was like in the 90s.
or 2002. That's you want right. to see the Die Another Day of improv comedy. Go check
no,
out.
No, don't promote it like that. Also,
Soundtrack on Fridays at UCB Franklin at 9:30.
If you enjoy Andy's theories, check out Star Trek, The Next Conversation. Right. Available wherever podcasts are listened.
All right, let's rate this thing.
I guess, do we go guests first? Or
sure.
Andy, what do you rate it? Okay, you want me to go first? I'm happy to go first.
Yeah, go first.
This movie, for me, gets a 001.
Same with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I would give it a 00, except I'm trying to think. I feel like you got to. My instinct is you're giving it a one because there's something redeemable in it.
No, it just watchability is the thing that matters more for me because even as bad as it is, I still marvel at it and my eyes are at times drawn to it.
Interesting.
Yeah. 001.
See, I would say the watching would make me knock it down to a zero.
I understand.
If you were saying
too.
There was, well, there was this good, Judy Dench is still good in it, and you look at it evaluatively. Yeah. Yeah, I give it a 1, too.
Okay, that's a solid 1 all
this
around.
This is the worst rated movie so far, and possibly ever.
And now I understand. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well.
So next 2 weeks from now, it's my choice, and I think it's no surprise what's coming, because it's a Christmas movie. It's the closest a Bond movie gets to a Christmas movie, and it's an exciting
time. Is that the one with Denise Richards?
No, although no. That just has a Christmas name.
The name is Christmas in
there. We're going to do On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Whoa!
Does it happen at Christmas? Why is that?
Sure does.
Yeah, it does.
Interesting.
It even has a song in it called Where Do Christmas Trees Come From?
Really?
Yeah.
I have no memory.
All right, George Lazenby, you're going to be watched next week.
Yeah.
Can I plug my Instagram?
Sure.
Yeah, sure, buddy.
Follows my Instagram.
You need to get beef
at Andrew Secunda. It's my full name.
All right.
Andrew Secunda.
Secunda.
That's correct.
There we go. Secunda Down Under is also a show he does on the Las Vegas Strip.
You don't call it Secunda Down Under?
I mean, I say that when I go.
Can you please go to Australia? Accent. Can you go to Australia and just use that hashtag for all your vacation photos?
Oh, please. You got it. You got it.
Oh, we all have to buy him a trip to Australia just to see that hashtag come out.
I don't know why I came here.
Well, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks for swinging through.
He'll be back again, I'm sure.
Enjoy the podcast very much.
Thank you.
Oh, definitely bring me back for Indy.
You got it.
Yeah.
Indiana Jonesing. It's happening. I don't know when, but soon.
James right. Bonding
will return. James Bonding Podcast.
Oh yeah, the wait is over. Womp It Up is back. Back, bitches. Every Tuesday, new episodes of Womp It Up are delivered hot and fresh to your inbox.
Just like a DiGiorno pizza.
Going straight up your butt.
Featuring all of your comedy faves, returning faves, and new faves alike.
Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app.
Womp It Up.
Hashtag turnaround.
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Hey, Hey, this is Arnie Niekamp from the Improv Fantasy Podcast, Hello from the Magic Tavern. I fell through a dimensional portal behind a Burger King in Chicago into the magical land of Foon, and I started a podcast. Season 3 has just begun with a brand new adventure to defeat the Dark Lord. If you're a new listener or you've fallen behind, Season 3 is a great jumping on point. And we've got great guests like Justin McElroy.
I sound like a fancy college professor. Eight nuts.
Rachel Bloom.
You all see my collection of men corpses and one woman.
Felicia Day and Colton Dunn.
You've seen me have intercourse with a variety of species.
It's a bummer.
Andy Daly.
You have the members of Genesis listed, but Phil Collins is crossed out and then circled and crossed out again.
Yes, I have killed Phil Collins twice.
Thomas Middleditch.
Jesus! I mean, Jazos, ruler of the Eighth Circle.
And that's just the beginning. Season 3 of Hello from the Magic Tavern is out now. Listen in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.